From the Missouri School of Journalism, welcome to Global Journalist. I'm Jason McClure. When you hear the phrase witch hunt, many think of the Salem witch trials back in 17th century Massachusetts. But the practice of labeling women witches and persecuting them for alleged sorcery still takes place today in rural areas of a number of different countries in Africa, Asia, the Pacific, and elsewhere. Now, one place where witch hunts are most prevalent today is in India, where the country's Crime Statistics Bureau calculates that more than 2,500 people, almost all women, have been killed in witch hunts between 2000 and 2016. Some were tortured or publicly humiliated before being burned, beaten, or stabbed to death. Now, there's not great data on this issue, but what exists shows that many of these mob attacks on women accused of witchcraft have taken place in central and eastern India and the rural parts of states like Madhya Pradesh and Odisha, particularly in villages where traditional shamans or medicine men have a big influence on village life. Now, in a few minutes, we'll hear from three people who have been tracking this issue closely to talk about both the history of these attacks and what might be done to stop them in the future. First, we're going to bring in Ashwak Masoodi. She's an Indian newspaper journalist who's covered this issue. She joins us on the line now from New Delhi. Ashwak, welcome.
Thank you, Jason.
Well, this phenomenon of witch hunts has happened in many countries all around the world. India is a huge and very diverse country. Maybe if you could just start off by telling us how widespread is this belief in witchcraft? Where do you see it?
So, I mean, you've already given the statistics, but to sort of give you a picture in a more concrete way, I would just say that, you know, on an average, there's one person who's killed every third day in India in the name of witch hunting. And when we say that, it's basically just basing it on the reported stories. There are others which are not even reported in the first place. So these are just the ones which we have, which, you know, either have gone to the police or, you know, the newspapers have reported on it. So women have been branded as witches. You've already mentioned a little, but, you know, they're not murdered. So what else happens if they are fortunate enough to be just fortunate enough to not be killed? So what happens with them? They're made to walk naked through the village. They're gang raped. Their breasts are cut off. Their teeth have been instances where the teeth were broken, the heads tonsured, and, you know, apart from obviously the fact that they've been ostracized from the village. So there have been cases where witches have actually, the women who've been termed, who've been called witches, have been branded as witches. They were also forced to swallow urine, and in cases they were forced to eat human flesh as well. So these are extreme cases, but, you know, they have been widespread in India, of course, but then Jharkhand in eastern India is the one which is among the it has been on the top of the chart of witch hunting murders for a while now.
Well, I want to talk about your reporting in Jharkhand in a moment, but maybe just tell us about what sorts of powers these women are alleged to have before they're attacked.
Basically, before answering that question, I would want to tell you what circumstances lead to such a labeling or branding. So it's always before, you know, there's a sudden death in the family or a couple of families in a village, or, you know, there's large scale death of cattle, or, you know, there's a famine, or, you know, even something as innocuous as inadequate monsoon rains, or, you know, someone fails to conceive. All of these just become reasons enough for a village or a community to sort of start looking for reasons as to why this is happening. So when this happens, women are actually identified. There's sort of an identification parade. You know, you have various, some different states have different ways of identifying a witch. But they always keep saying, I remember going to my, I mean, when I was in Jharkhand, I met someone who said, you know, it's very easy to find out a Dayan. Dayan is the word you use for witch in India. So he said that it's very easy to find a witch. You meet them because you can, he was so convinced. He said, you can see it in their eyes. You can see their feet. Their feet are, you know, they walk a certain way. They talk in a certain way. They look at you differently. You see a certain spark in their eyes. So they're actually convinced that that happens. But that said, I mean, there's this this part of it being superstition is just one aspect of witch hunting, which I really want to keep stressing on, because even though there were a good enough number of people who told me, yes, you know, this is because, you know, they're actually Dians, they're actually witches and all of that. But there were a lot of, you know, when you look at the backstory of it, it's not just superstition. So the reasons, if you actually categorize it, is, you know, most of the victims, you know, there are single women, they are unmarried, they are widowed. So the reasons have mostly been either land rights. It begins with land rights. It's lack of medical facilities in tribal areas mostly. So, you know, you have a famine, you have like a sudden, a few people die in the village. So
you visited a village, I think it was called Baralagra, where both a mother and a daughter had been attacked and killed. By the people, by their relatives, by people who lived in the same village as them. Maybe if you could just tell us their story.
So, I mean, that's the thing. It's a very similar story. You know, there's no, you know, there are two women who are fiercely independent. So that is a sort of a thing. That's again a problem. You know, they are the two women who were talking about, you know, they were very openly talking about the rights that they had and everything. So they were already, you know, they were chosen based on that. So that's the whole thing. And everyone was justifying, when I went and visited these places, this place, I mean, particularly the village, everyone was justifying the murder. No one actually was, to my surprise, there was no one actually saying that, you know, what happened was bad, because they were so convinced that they needed to be killed. And it was very gruesome, the way they were strangled, the way they were, you know, one of the bodies was actually pushed under a huge rock after they were literally dragged through the village. So, but the people kept saying that, you know, this was required. We had to do it. They were going to destroy us, our cattle.
What did the villagers say the motivation was to kill these two women? And this was in Charkhand, in eastern India.
Yeah. So that's the thing. They kept saying that, you know, why do you think our cow died? Suddenly a man tells me, you know, the next door neighbor is telling me, you know, why did the cow die? You know, three cows died. That can't happen suddenly. That obviously happened because of them. So they, for any kind of tragedy that happened in the neighborhood, they all attributed it to the women. So that's the whole thing. It's very easy. They become easy targets. One person, you know, for example, one family employs an ojha. That's basically a witch doctor. And the person says, identifies this one particular woman or two women. And then everyone, for anything that's happened in the village, everyone would attribute everything to these two women. So then it's just, you know, it's a cycle, and everyone is constantly blaming. And then the women obviously have no, I mean, how would they justify, you know, the entire village is pointing fingers at them. People are convinced that they are the ones who are responsible for whatever loss the other families are facing. So they obviously, I mean, there's no way they could protect themselves.
Well, Ashraq Masoodi, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
This is Global Journalist. On today's program, we're talking about the practice of witch hunts in India, where official statistics show that about 150 women each year are killed after being accused of sorcery. Now, we just spoke with the Indian newspaper journalist Ashwak Masoodi. To learn more about this, we're going to bring in three other people who have been tracking this issue. Joining us from New Delhi is Madhu Mehra. She's a lawyer and executive director of the group Partners for Law and Development. Also with us from Palo Alto, California, is Seema Yasmin. She's a journalist and medical doctor who's reported for outlets including the Dallas Morning News, Scientific American, and CNN. She's currently a John S. Knight Journalism Fellow at Stanford University. And on the line from New Delhi is Sheshank Sinha. He's an historian and author who has studied witch hunts in India and who currently works for the publishing company Routledge South Asia. Welcome to all of you. Madhu Mehra, let me start with you. You heard us talking earlier to Ashwak Masoodi about some of the statistics on women killed through witch hunts here. What are the prosecution rates and the conviction rates? How often are people brought to justice for doing this?
Well, I've looked at all the police cases in some of the districts in at least four states of India. And I've looked at all the High Court and Supreme Court judgments. So at the police station level, what we have is a lot of cases which are not necessarily of murder, but are of beating, evictions, destruction of property, and mob violence. All of it are orchestrated by a mob. But as you go into the legal system to look at the higher court judgments, you only come across murders, which does suggest that the larger chunk of cases are of everyday violence, social ostracism, and even eviction and dislocation from village, land and property. But what really enters the legal system is murder, which means to say that a lot of these smaller cases simply drop out and do not get legal redress, adequate legal redress. The murder cases that we found that reached the High Court and thereafter the Supreme Court, by the time they reach the Supreme Court, we find that half the convictions turn into acquittals. So to begin with, there must be many more cases, because all we get to see in the first court of appeal, which is the High Court, is the conviction and the acquittal cases. So we had about 60 cases as the entire universe we studied. That's up to 2012. And in that, by the time we reach the Supreme Court, those 60 cases, only 21 continue with sustain the convictions. So they all drop out. And the reason for dropping out is very poor investigations, key witnesses not being called for during the trial. And so it's a very weak case to sustain beyond reasonable doubt. And in many instances, the higher courts are absolutely despairing about the quality of investigation and prosecution. And they know that that the accused are possibly the convicts, but they keep expressing their disappointment in the way there is not enough evidence available for them to convict.
So it sounds like there are many problems with the prosecution then, starting at the police level, where only the very most serious cases are investigated, and then throughout the legal process, it sounds like there are many other issues related to prosecution and appeals. Absolutely. I want to come back to this issue, but if I could turn this to you, Seema Yasmeen, what did you think about this issue? What were some of your preconceived notions about it sort of going in, and how did that change as you reported on it?
It certainly became more complex and more nuanced the more that I learned about it. And one of the reasons why I was really keen to understand more and to report on this issue was that there had been such little reporting in the press outside of India, and I wanted to change that. I did go in with this idea that, I'll go to a few states in India and I'll talk to women and I'll talk to activists and NGOs in a few different areas. And then when I got to Gujarat itself, which is where my family is from, I felt really like there's a deeper story here, and I don't want to do the disservice of trying to make this issue seem like it's not complicated, because I learned that perhaps the underlying issues, you know, the reasons why this was going on in Gujarat might be a little different to what's going on in Assam in the Far East, or what's going on in Jharkhand. And I'm glad I really focused on the stories of Gujarati women for these stories, at least, although, of course, this is a phenomenon that's occurring across India.
And Shashank Sina, if I could turn this to you, you heard Seema Yasmeen talking about how this is a phenomenon that's happening across India, and you've spent years researching this issue. Tell us, if you would, about some of the history behind it. How frequent were witch hunts or witch killings, say, 150 years ago compared with now?
You know, it's very difficult to arrive at figures because, you know, witches were killed. The idea was to establish a murder. But, you know, very broadly speaking, you know, I can, you know, talk about, you know, my primary research has been on Jharkhand, but with comparative evidence from, you know, the whole of the central Indian belt, you know, I can see at least four phases, four very distinct phases. You know, the first phase is around, you know, say around middle of 19th century, you know, where there are cases of, you know, the whole construction of witchcraft was such that, you know, a witch was thought to be born, you know. Right, which means so you're born as a witch, and it was considered, the art was considered hereditary. So, you know, when they would, you know, kill the witch, they'll kill the entire family members because it was considered hereditary.
So there was this view that this was something that you were born with, that your family sort of carried with you, but that began to change.
Yeah, that began to change towards, you know, later 19th, early 20th century. Now, there are few things emerge, some very distinct tendencies which emerge, This is also a period where, this is a period under colonial rule, with the mature period of colonial rule, where the ethnographers and anthropologists are documenting, the Christian missionaries are documenting, the administrators are documenting. So the first thing that you see is a lot of recording or documentation which happens. And in the process, what happens is, you get first definitions of witchcraft. Now, in the process of documenting witchcraft, what they ended up doing is unconsciously, they ended up institutionalizing the belief, And that, they produced a body of knowledge which served as
So in other words, then the very people who were starting to document this phenomenon came to institutionalize it. But as I recollect, you said that this was actually, you seemed to say there was some evidence that this declined for much of the 20th century, that there wasn't as much documentation of attacks on witches, of killings on witches through much of the 20th century. And then that seemed to change.
Yeah, that seemed to change. But let me just complete one more point, where I was, just talking about is that, and then the other, the construction of witch changes as well. So as opposed to a born witch, you have a trained witch, a witch gets trained, a witch which has to learn rituals, the collectivity of witchcraft, the gatherings, witch gatherings, these are the things which start becoming common. And with the constructions of craft and witch hunting also are very, very related to each other. So other things that you come into being, while earlier they were being killed, now you see, exorcism rituals, lots of sacrifices, also monetization of witch trials, that is happening. And then, say middle of, 20th century or middle of 20th century, there is a phase of decline, And the phase that we are talking about, which Madhu, Aswak and, Seema talked about, is the phase of modern witch hunts, in the last, three, four decades, where the dynamics have changed completely, both in relation to the constructions of a witch or the meaning of a witch, and also related to the dynamics of witch hunting. And one of the other points that I want to, make clear is a point that Madhu was making, that, there is a difference between witch hunting and witch killing. So the figures that we are talking about are figures about witch killing, not about witch hunting, but witch hunting takes place in a more profound ways through a lot of activities.
And this may be something that doesn't necessarily end in the killing of a witch, then, is what you're saying, is that this practice of witch hunting goes on, it's much more widespread, or was more widespread previously, but what's happened more recently, it sounds like, is that some of these incidents have become more violent. But let me turn this to Madhu Mehra, if I could then. Talk to us just a little bit about what you see as some of the motivations for this. Sheshank was talking about the superstition, but it sounds like there are other motivations perhaps beyond that.
So in all the cases that I've looked at, I've understood that it's a kind of demonization when you want to isolate and delegitimize someone and prepare the basis for eventually legitimizing all kinds of violence or exclusion against them. And superstition might be an easy vocabulary that is available in the current context of demonizing. But the reasons really are quite different, and we found that there were economic jealousies, prosperities amongst peers, not necessarily amongst very divergent groups, often in the same extended family, because a lot of my sort of data is about women who are targeted by their extended relatives or their neighbors. It could be a stepmother that is not liked, or even a farm laborer who's demanding her wages and who's not been given wages for some time. So there could be various reasons which end up creating a situation of showing or putting a person in their place. And legitimizing such violence or a collective action. But interestingly, in the case documentation carried out by my organization through field workers who are embedded in the community, showed that there's more than one narrative within the community. It is not as if everyone buys the witch hunting narrative. It's not as if everyone believes that there is witchcraft involved. You hear about different perspectives on the story through neighbors who are too fearful of speaking out loud.
Seema Yasmin can add to that. You spoke with some woman in Gujarat. I think their names were Susilaben and Madhuben, who had been in some sort of conflict with men they were related to over using going to the bathroom in their fields, basically. And the conflict just seemed to get much worse over time. Tell us what happened to them.
That's correct. So this story was about women who had been bequeathed land, and they owned really fertile land and were making their living from farming this land and growing lentils and things. And male relatives were jealous of them, didn't believe that they deserved this land, didn't believe that women should have access to this. And so, like many people in India, they defecated outside, but the men chose to defecate where the women grew their food. And the women were so upset about this, they dared to speak up. And that's when they were run out of their home, and that's when the mob attacks began. And I have to agree with Madhu that it's complicated and it's so nuanced, and that's why I kind of wanted to focus my story on one region, on a few women. But what I did find that connected all of these women and that connected the phenomenon of witch hunting was patriarchy and misogyny, a deep hatred of women and a belief that women shouldn't have land, shouldn't have a home. So there were different reasons I found that women would be targeted. Sometimes there'd be an outbreak of an illness in a village and somebody would say, it's her fault, she's a witch. And that woman would be burned or tortured or killed or assaulted. Sometimes a well would run dry. Sometimes there'd be a bad harvest. And again, a woman would be found to be a witch and to be blamed for that. And I also found that it was very rarely one man up against one woman. One man might single a woman out as a witch, but it was very often a mob that would descend. And people, like Madhu said, didn't always buy into this narrative, but often just felt really disempowered and couldn't say anything. I went to one village with some NGO workers where a woman had recently been murdered, and they were collecting information to find out what happened. And we spoke to women who were also attacked during that same mob attack when the woman was killed. They were so frightened to speak out. And even the NGO staff said they had to wait a few months before they could go into this village because it was dangerous for them, because the men who had murdered the woman and who had attacked other women were powerful. They were doctors and accountants and lawyers. They held high status, and it was dangerous for them.
Well, Sheshank Sinha, Seema raised a couple different points there. I know you want to jump in on something that Madhu was saying as well. But one thing that Seema had mentioned was that some of the women that she had reported on owned land, and that there, some of their male relatives were jealous of this or resentful of the fact that the women had this source of wealth and didn't feel like they should own it, that was maybe a primary motivation for these attacks. Talk to us just a little bit about that.
Just one clarification first, you know, because I always believe that, you know, it was never going to be only superstition. So, I mean, my idea of, you know, talking to you about the trajectory of witch killings and witch hunting or the constructions of witchcraft is that, you know, it's a very dynamic and evolving process. And this has changed over a period of time. So what are we talking about in the last couple of decades did not exist earlier. Now, let me come to the motivations part. In the modern witch hunts, you know, three or four different kinds of motivations I can see, some of which Madhu and Seema have talked about, you know. One is, you know, the village tensions, you know, village and social tensions and the gender tensions that are there. You know, we can roughly assume patriarchy gets covered there, you know. Land grabbing, and not just land grabbing, but other kinds of resources. So women who are holding other kinds of land resources as well. Then you have a lot of power politics at play as well. You know, whether it is, you know, intercaste or whether it is intra-caste or intra-tribe, there's a power politics at play as well. And then recently in the last, in a couple of decades, the
Just to clarify, Sheshank, so this isn't a phenomenon that's limited to one ethnic group or one religious group then?
It is not limited. And therefore, I strongly believe that, you know, we need to move beyond stereotypes. And some of the stereotypes are that, you know, it is, you know, limited to tribal groups. It is not limited to tribal groups. We have evidence of witchcraft in the past and, you know, in witch hunting in the present as well, where, you know, Muslims, you know, Dalit communities, socially oppressed and excluded communities are, you know, being targeted, you know. It is as much, we can also see it in urban contexts as well, cases of witch hunting. So it's not, it's not just that, certainly not.
So it sounds like it's something that is sort of pervasive to an extent in rural areas in many parts of the country. But Madhu Mehra, I understand that there are something like a dozen states in India that have passed laws, or I guess you'd call them anti-witch hunting laws. Talk to us about how effective those are.
So there are about seven states that have passed laws, and the earlier laws have been completely ineffective because the whole idea was to have an explicit law on witch hunting with that name, but really have no teeth in the law. And now more and more states have been asking for laws. So in the recent 5 years, we've seen Orissa, Rajasthan, and Assam pass laws. We've seen Maharashtra pass a broader law, which is against superstition, not just against witch hunting. And unfortunately, the focus of a lot of these laws are on criminalization alone. And we know that the criminal justice system is so apathetic towards the poor as victims. So,
And I'm sorry, Madhu, we're just losing your audio there. But it sounds like these laws. It sounds like even in places where there may be good laws on the books, there aren't necessarily being enforced or applied, particularly in some rural areas.
There is a problem in just focusing on criminal law, because criminal laws aim to only convict the accused. And we know if the legal system is loaded against the poor, this is unlikely to happen. What such laws end up doing is providing no support to victims who have to live with exclusion, live with impoverishment, because they face economic and social boycott.
Well, Madhu, we're almost out of time.
Is essentially...
I just want to give the last word to Seema Yasmin. You heard Madhu describing some of the problems with laws there. Is there some reason for optimism that things may change in the future, that things can improve for some of the women who have been accused?
Honestly, it's devastating, right? It's obscene and it's absurd that this is still happening. And it was depressing and terrifying sometimes covering this story. But where I found real hope was witnessing the solidarity that these women who had been affected were building. They were building community. And some of the women in the rural areas had built a kind of a sisterhood, like an on-call system. And they were going from hut to hut in the village saying, if a man talks to you like this, if a man calls you a witch, if someone tries to hurt you or your children, you call us. This is our number. And we will come en masse, because we know that we are vulnerable as women, that if 25 of us come and support you and walk you to the police station and demand that the police write down what happened and call it a witch hunt if it was, then they knew that that's where their power was. And to me, that gave me some hope that there are people working at the higher levels trying to implement policy, trying to change the law. But what can we do for the women who are suffering these attacks and this stigma day to day? And where I found that hope was just in witnessing the solidarity and in these sisterhoods.
Well, we're out of time for this edition of Global Journalist, a production of the Reynolds Journalism Institute at the Missouri School of Journalism and KBIA Mid-Missouri Public Radio. Many thanks to Ashwak Masudi, Madhu Mehra, Seema Yasmin, and Sheshank Sinha. Our assistant producers this week are Teodora Agarici and Rosemary Belson, with supervising producer Edom Kasaye. Jiwan Choi is visual editor, Aaron Hay is audio engineer, Travis McMillan is our director. For all of us at Global Journalist, I'm Jason McClure. Thanks for tuning in.